The final speaker in SILT 2011, I know it's such a sad moment, but it's a wonderful, not your present. But Pete Slay, this is, I could talk a lot about the sort of peculiar way we met years ago, but Peter Slay nonetheless teaches now in the history of Christianity and Christian thought at Ashland University. And when I was, I should fill in some details because that makes it sound kind of weird the way I just said that. I was giving a book talk in Oxford, Mississippi, and I don't know, the spring of 1998, something like that. And this was an event at this wonderful book store and reading gallery called Square Books. And Richard Holworth is this legendary bookseller in Mississippi, and Charles Reagan Wilson, who runs the Center for the Study of Southern Culture, not knowing me from Adam, put on this wonderful evening sort of surrounding readings for my book, and we had a gospel choir, and we had Caroline Herring's group, what was it called, and then the guy who was the cousin, the sister of the Wilco bass player, what, Blue Mountain? Yeah. And C-SPAN was there, several dozen people watched it eventually on television. And during this Q&A, this British fellow stood up in the back of the room, and he wanted to know what Fannie Lou Hamer had to do with Dietrich Bonhoeffer. So I said, that's an interesting question. I haven't been asked that in, Picayune, Mississippi, and the ye old haunted bookstore in the French quarters. So we started talking, and Pete was finishing a master's in documentary studies at the University of Mississippi, where he had written a history of the gospel choir at Ole Miss, and also been a part of that gospel choir, hence the Grammy nomination. So the entire Ole Miss gospel choir was flown out to L.A. I guess you were having parties with Eric Clapton and all of this kind of craziness. And it also had done an undergraduate degree at St. Andrews and written an undergraduate thesis on Bonhoeffer. So I said, why don't you come to Virginia in the fall? And then he came. We had you had no idea what you're doing. I had no idea what I was doing either. I was much more clueless than you were at that point, and you were really stupid to trust me. But I'm glad you did. Anyway, so this book came out. There's a very interesting story I'm sure you're going to tell us about. Open Friendship in a Closed Society, Mission Mississippi and the Theology of Friendship, that Oxford published in 2009. That's subsequently got you in a lot of hot water, but in interesting ways. So wonderful having you back, and it's all yours, Pete.
Thank you. I feel like we need to do something to do in church. We'd like to stand up and greet your neighbor and just move around a little bit and then sit down, because if you're tired, I mean, seriously, could you do that? Because otherwise you'll go to sleep on me, because it's the end of the day. Yeah, I don't know. Say neighbor, I don't know. Okay, now the band starts playing and you sit down again. Oh no, I let one get away. Yeah, that's right. What you'll notice, I saw this morning, is that I was supposed to start at 3:30, but the break was supposed to run concurrently with my presentation, if you look at this. But you didn't spot that, and you're all still here, so that's good. My paper this afternoon has the title, Part of the Body, Reflections on Risks and Responsibilities in the Discipline of Lived Theology. And as is often the case with me, I came up with the title before I had written anything. Reflections seemed vague enough not to commit me to anything in particular, and risks and responsibilities, as well as being an alliteration, sounded slightly dark and intriguing. So I was interested to find out what I was going to write. As most of you know by now, Charles was my dissertation advisor here at UVA, and the dissertation became a book, Open Friendship in a Closed Society, a title I came up with before I'd written anything at all. And it's a long road from fieldwork to published book, 6 to 9 years in my case, but what I'm discovering is that the process continues. These new experiences have led me to think about the place of the lived theologian, if there is such a thing. We never really discussed that degree. So the first part of my paper will consider this. And the second part, at the request of Charles, I'll share some of my thoughts and experiences on setting out to write a theological narrative based on my ethnographic research of religious communities. And hopefully, there'll be some connection between the two. So first, a reflection on the location of the lived theologian. Yesterday, Manuel Vasquez challenged us to develop a carnal theology that takes material seriously, to learn from the ethnographer Waquant, who advocated a sociology from the body. This requires a rich and fully engaged ethnographic approach to the subject. For those concerned with lived theology, the bodies in question are religious communities. For me, as a Christian theologian or historian or whatever it is that I am, this word body obviously has a particular resonance that has significance beyond the particular community I choose to study. So, returning to my question, what is the place of the lived theologian? The simple answer, of course, is that the Christian lived theologian is properly located in the church. But this smacks of a Sunday school answer, the right answer. It is the right answer, and thanks to Jenny, I now know that Bonhoeffer agrees with me in Act and Being, so that's always reassuring. It is the right answer, but how to do lived theology in the church is far from obvious. These are the questions of method and location that dominate the start of a research project, and I'll address those later. But first, I want to turn to the questions that come at the end when the project is finished, the book written, the paper presented. These are also questions of location, of intention, of risks and responsibilities. This reflection on the location of the lived theologian is not an anemic academic exercise. It is grounded in my own experience of trying to figure out what lived theology might be in my work and the repercussions this has had for me and the communities I studied. So I'll tell a story which illustrates the risks and responsibilities of a lived theologian, how doing lived theology in, or to use Manuel's language, from this place can get awkward. A story, bedtime story. How does the bedtime story end? We were talking last night. Now go to... Yeah, okay. Okay, a story. In March this year, I took a group of 8 students to spend their spring break in Jackson, Mississippi, volunteering with Voice of Calvary Ministries and revisiting many of the people, organizations, and situations that I'd studied 6 years earlier in my doctoral research. This was not my first time visiting Jackson after my book was published, but it was the first time since people had noticed I had written a book. At 6:45 on Tuesday morning, my 8 students from Ohio dragged themselves into a Mission Mississippi prayer breakfast at St. Joseph's Hospital. They picked up some coffee, yogurt, and pastries, and, on strict instructions from their professor, scattered themselves through the room to chat with the collection of Mission Mississippi regulars, hospital staff, doctors, and administrators. These prayer breakfasts are intentional interracial intercessory prayer meetings that take place in different venues across Jackson every Tuesday and Thursday morning. I'd been to many of these prayer breakfasts. They're the central practice of this racial reconciliation organization. As I looked around the room, I saw Dolphus Weary, the executive director of Mission Mississippi. I'd not spoken with Weary since my book had been published, though I had sent him a copy. He gave a rueful chuckle as we shook hands. "Your book's been mixing things up," he said. When it was time to start praying, Weary called the breakfasters to order. "Peter, stand up. We've got a young man with us this morning, Peter Slade, and he wrote a book about Mission Mississippi. He's here this morning with his students. I may be wrong, but this did not feel like the usual church greeting, acknowledging visitors. Dolphus Weary was calling me out, making me stand out and stand up. I was no longer the researcher quietly participating, taking notes and recording interviews. But what was I exactly? I pondered this as I bowed my head and prayed with my small group of Catholics and Protestants, black, white, and Latino, under the fluorescent lights in the basement of the hospital. I knew which part of the book had been mixing things up. I'd spent a long chapter, chapter 4, if you want to skip it, getting to the roots of why this racial reconciliation organization does not mention justice. The answer cut very deep for whites, particularly white Southern Presbyterians, back to the defense of slavery and on through white supremacy and Jim Crow. The church is about the business of word and sacrament, they said. Justice is not our job. But why did the African-American leaders of Mission Mississippi go along with this? Dolphus Weary was the protege of veteran community activist John Perkins and had been his chosen successor at Voice of Calvary in Mendenhall. I concluded that they'd not forgotten about justice. Rather, they saw the importance of keeping the whites at the table long enough to start a conversation. For them, this was only Reconciliation 101. I knew John Perkins had read my book. I was busy not signing any copies at a conference in Cincinnati back in 2009 when he took a copy from my table. I'd also heard that he had taken one thing from it. Mission Mississippi, the organization run by the man he had mentored, would not address issues of injustice. He was pissed. As the prayer meeting came to a close at 7:45 and the room emptied, Dolphus Weary sat with my students and graciously talked to them about the difficult task of bringing the gospel message of reconciliation to Mississippi's churches and how hard it is to get Christians to stop talking and start listening. Towards the end of the conversation, Weary referred to the strained relationship he now had with John Perkins. "He's my father in the faith," he said sadly. "But JP came to the table not ready to listen. He just wanted to say his piece." Driving back in the van, my students wanted to know what on earth their professor had written that these people actually cared about. As I talked, we passed First Presbyterian Church. Back in 2003, its session had first approved my research project, and then after further deliberation, barred me from seeing any church documents. If I were so much as to talk to church members without checking with the elders first, then, I was told to my face, "You will be very sorry." I'm hoping to write a congregational history. It'll only work if people want to participate. I don't want to cause any trouble. I tried to sound reassuring. "Trouble? Don't you worry about that. We know how to handle trouble." 7 years later, when the conservative Presbyterian blogosphere became very energized about my book, the minister of First Pres, Ligon Duncan, accused me of bias or of poor scholarship. He left this comment on a blog. "There are a lot of gaps in his presentation of this story. I'll write more to you privately about this and perhaps post some facts that Mr. Slade has failed to mention in his book." As the PCA blogs piled up, the Chancellor of Reformed Theological Seminary responded with a pastoral letter on his own blog, and I received invitations to lecture at both the denomination's undergraduate college and seminary. I'd responded to Ligon Duncan, but he'd never written back. "I was hoping to have a chat with him while I was down here," I told the students in the van. "Do it now, Dr. Slade." They were fired up from coffee and their early morning exposure to Christian reconciliation. You need to meet with him." I was trapped. Followed by a gaggle of undergraduates, I walked across the parking lot, past the pastel-wearing moms dropping their children off at the day school, past the armed guard, past the security camera. We were buzzed into the church offices. With my students watching, pulse racing and hat in hand, "Hi, my name is Peter Slade." I dropped my hat on the floor. I wondered if I could see Dr. Duncan. "He's not here right now, but you can talk with his secretary to set up an appointment." Later that day, we sat down for lunch at Voice of Calvary Ministries with Phil Reed, another veteran of community building and reconciliation. "I agree with what you said in your book," Reed confided, "but you've caused a stir." He went on to tell me of the ugly scenes between Perkins and Weary, but Reed had more to report than this fractured relationship. Nettie Dolphus and myself, we've been meeting with Ronnie Crudup from New Horizons. We're developing a curriculum on justice for evangelical churches. That's funny. I saw Dolphus this morning and he didn't mention it. Dolphus and Nettie haven't taken it to the board yet. I said this was a story, but it's not a very satisfying one. There's no ending. But my discomfort that morning in Mississippi was threefold. One, I was uncomfortable in my relationship with the church. In the instance of the prayer meeting, I was uncomfortable because my easy relationship with the community I'd studied and in a small way participated in was no longer an easy place for me to go. In the case of First Prez, the prospect of meeting with these powerful Christians made me extremely anxious. They'd been less than cooperative in the past. They'd actually threatened me. And they did that before I'd put a less than flattering history of their congregation in print. Two, I was uncomfortable with the effect of my work on the relationships between people I had written about. I was sorry that anything I had written would have strained the relationship between two men, Dolphus Weary and John Perkins, both of whom I hold in very high regard. Three, I was uncomfortable that my work had changed the organizations I had studied. It made me nervous to hear that what I had written had helped precipitate a significant change in Mission Mississippi, or a potential change. And I was not prepared for that kind of responsibility. What business did I have to write anything? What was my rightful place in all this? And how could I run away? How could I get out of this place? Let me explain what generates this anxiety in me. The anxiety over actually have people changing stuff because of what I've written. I came to the project on Lived Theology with some training in oral history and documentary work after studying with Tom Rankin, Bill Ferris, Karen Glynn, and David Wharton at the Center for the Study of Southern Culture at the University of Mississippi. One thing that I had drilled into me is that good documentary fieldwork interferes as little as possible with the subject of study. Someone engaged in documentary study should have a hyper-self-reflexive understanding of the impact of their presence on the subject. There's a great deal of hand-wringing over the unintended impact of the researcher on the community studied. I also have a background in community development work. I studied the subject at Ruskin College in Oxford while employed as a community worker for the Church of England. The good community worker is very conscious of their own role and influence in the community, and they try and work themselves out of a job. So the best documentarian, ethnographer, or anthropologist leaves the subject as he found it. The good community worker leaves the community stronger than she found it. What my experiences in Mississippi made me realize is that the faithful lived theologian never leaves the community of saints, the object of study. Whether they like it or not, they are part of the body. Jim Morrison said, "No one gets out of here alive." But thanks to the hope of the resurrection, even that possibility of escaping this place is ruled out. Mary McClintock-Forkerson points out in her book, Places of Redemption, theologians engaged in such a project come to the subject with their own theological convictions. Forkerson, quoting Charles Winquist, points out that, quote, creative thinking originates at the scene of a wound, and a number of us have picked up on that over the last couple of days. In my case, I was conducting my research not just in libraries, but in physical proximity to the wound of injustice and racism in Mississippi. Fulkerson also points out that Christian theology is creative in the presence of such wounds because theology is an inquiry shaped by a logic of transformation. This is important and should make us pause because it points out the risks and responsibilities involved in such a project. What or who is being transformed? If this is the theological inquiry, then clearly the theology and the theologian is subject to this logic of transformation. If there is to be no change, then there's no point in the study. But far more uncomfortable to me is the idea that the people I am studying will be changed by this conversation. This is not simply because of my background in documentary work, but also because, if post-colonial studies tells me anything, it's that as a white English man, I need to be very nervous of my colonial tendencies. With all this talk of the lived theologian's location being in the church, I do not wish to pass over the rather obvious fact that the lived theologian is also professionally located in the academy. There are fundamental differences between the university and the church. But moving in and between these worlds means that the lived theologian has to develop a theological double consciousness. So it's interesting we had Du Bois earlier. So we have to develop a theological double consciousness. The one important theological point to note is that despite the temporal ordering of our lives, the church is our primary and preeminent location. Whichever world we're operating in, it's clear which one is our home. After all, Jesus said, "I'll build my church and the gates of hell shall not prevail against it." There are no such reassuring words in Scripture for the university chancellors and presidents. So what's my point? From my perspective, to engage in the process of writing lived theology, a worldly carnal theology in a worldly carnal world means an inescapable engagement with the worldly carnal church. This place of the lived theologian as part of the body of Christ, is tricky and uncomfortable because it means an openness to being changed, but also means accepting the responsibility that you will change others. It may, as Charles suggested yesterday, seem to involve betrayal. But the betrayer cannot escape the betrayed. Indeed, we need to be reconciled to those we have betrayed. We need to have the will to embrace those whom we've pissed off. The philosopher Oliver Hardy could have been addressing the question or predicament of lived theology when he said, "That's another fine mess you've gotten me into. How did I get myself into this mess?" When I started studying with Charles in 2000, the task of the project on lived theology, as it was explained, or at least as I understood it, was to collapse the distance between the academic study of theology, particularly systematic theology, and the lived experience of the people in the pews, to get theologians to study communities with some of the attention they usually reserve for texts, to remind theologians that they should have this theological double consciousness, if you like. The conviction that I shared with Marsh was that so much academic theology seems to have been dislocated. This is why in the preface to my book I wrote this, quoting some great book by Slade, here it comes. "Christian theologians call the church the body of Christ, but rarely do they go and look at this body to find out what they might learn about Christ, the object of their study. Underlying this book is the conviction that they should. Congregations and faith communities develop their own lived theologies embodied in their practices and proclamations, and theologians need to be in conversation with these lived theologies if academic theology is to stay true to its calling to serve the church, and if local churches' beliefs and practices are not to become intellectually impoverished. But how to set about this task? For me, it was not quite a journey without maps, but it was close. So now we're into the much shorter second part of my paper, how I set out to research and write my book, and a couple of things I learned along the way. Actually, three, so a couple plus one. As I set out, I had a strong commitment to bringing academic theology into conversation with the lived theology of Christian communities. One immediate problem that such a conversation runs into is the great distance in vocabulary separating the lecture hall from the sanctuary. The lived theologian who inhabits both places has to learn to code switch, to be fluent in both languages. An example of that was I was interviewing people, trying to get them to sort of talk about their experience of praying with people of a different race than themselves, and I was getting nothing. And then I thought about this, and I changed my question. I said, "Please give me your testimony of praying." And suddenly, boom! Everyone's got a testimony, and I managed to code switch and effectively. But when it comes to writing a book, you have to choose to use a single voice. You can't code it. It would be a very freaky book if the voice kept changing as you were reading it. A key methodological concern for me, therefore, was how to work with both the highly articulate and often obscure vocabulary of academic theology and the lived theology of the average churchgoer. The written word is the natural habitat of the academic theologian, and we've talked a lot about that. In this medium, their words tend to carry more authority on the page, thus making any equal exchange very difficult. The temptation is to remedy this imbalance by translating practices and stories of faith into the language of academic theology. Let me tell you what they're really saying. To do this, however, is to lose the authentic voices of lived theology and to risk patronizing the subject. That was what I perceived as a danger. Here I'm influenced by my background in oral history. In my research, I conducted a significant number of extended interviews. When I came to write, I drew on my transcriptions of interviews, ensuring that participants in Mission Mississippi retained their own voice in this conversation, and I included descriptions of their practices. This leads on to my second thing I was concerned about and lessons learned. Accompanying my concern of equal exchange is my conviction that as far as it is possible, the work should be accessible to the people who are the subject of the study. The theology doesn't just come from the body, it should be for the body. And I guess my attempt to be able to write stuff that people could read is actually what got me into trouble. My success was my undoing. To address these concerns of equal exchange and accessibility, I decided to present both academic and lived theologies using biographical narrative. I wanted to write a book that regular literate folk could read and might even enjoy doing so. Lofty ambition. I was inspired to try this task after reading John M. Barrie's fantastic book, Rising Tide, about the Mississippi flood of 1927. In Barrie's book, the human stories kept me turning the pages, and by the end I realized that he'd tricked me. I now knew quite a lot of technical theory about the science of hydrodynamics, navigable waterways, and the history of the Corps of Engineers. You know, when they said they're opening the sluice gates and the water's going down the Atchafalaya, I'm like, oh, I totally understand that. I was helped in my task by the fact that two of the main theologians I used, Moltmann and Wolff, have fascinating biographies. Not just fascinating biographies, but they intersect. Wolff was Moltmann's student. And Wolff credits Moltmann for asking him the question that ended up turning into his book, Exclusion and Embrace. I also found out that it isn't in the book, but Will Campbell shared a room with Jürgen Moltmann at a conference, and they drank a bottle of bourbon together. But I couldn't quite work that narrative. I also found that presenting academic theology woven into a biographical and historical narrative levels the playing field by demonstrating that the academic lived theology dichotomy is in fact false. Just as for the regular person in the pew, theologians' religious beliefs and convictions spring, at least in part, from their reflection upon their own lived faith in their particular cultural context. 3, we should practice what we preach and allow the lived theology of the community we are studying, its wisdom gained from practice, to contribute to the theological direction and conclusions of our work, even if we think we know better than them. In my case, I was writing about racial reconciliation in Mississippi and the people who had been involved with Mission Mississippi for 15 years. They insisted that what made it all work was that they met regularly for prayer breakfasts. I decided that I should take this claim seriously and bring an ethnographic study of their prayer breakfast into conversation with academic theologies of reconciliation. When I told Charles that this was going to be my concluding chapter, he was less than impressed. "Of course they'd say that. They're a bunch of Baptists from Mississippi," he told me. But Charles is a gracious advisor, so after telling me he thought my last chapter was going to be crap and a bit weak, he let me dig my own grave. In the end, it's the part of my book of which I'm most proud. When Charles read it, he sent me an email. "Okay, you convinced me," he wrote. So, to conclude, the lived theologian is part of the church, part of the body of Christ. This not only locates the object of study, but also the location of the scholar and the location of the audience for the work. And it remains our location after the work has been shared. Taken seriously, this must influence how we first engage in ethnographic research and then how we write an honest story set against the distant horizon of a triune God. It is also where we need to experience the repercussions of our work and where we will seek forgiveness and reconciliation.